I didn't realize it was time. It is time. I want to finish up a few thoughts that we had on the church and then move into some other things as we work our way through some of these things we were asked to consider. We spent quite a bit of time yesterday on the name of the church, and there were several comments I didn't get to at the end, and some of you have come up and made those comments, and I think they were all good. But one of them that I think Janet asked, and I don't see her yet, but she'll be here, was how do we keep from elevating people unduly? And someone suggested and maybe took my explanation just a little bit further. One of them is to just get to know them. And you find out that they're human and no different than you and can be right and can be wrong, be it evangelists, elders, or just senior people in the congregation that are respected. And another person made the comment that it behooves people to try to do what they can to make sure they aren't exalted. And in general, I think the congregations I'm familiar with and the brethren and the sisters that I'm familiar with do a pretty good job about that. I don't personally think if anyone I know in the church left, they would automatically take half of congregations with them, as has happened in the past. Now, that could happen, but I don't sense that, and I think that's much healthier than some of the things that we've observed in the past. Another comment that was made was, I made the comment yesterday about how sometimes we extol the public part of the service of Christian work more than we should. Not that it's not worthy of it, but the other stuff is equally important. And someone made the comment, how many times do we tell someone they gave a good table talk versus how many times we go up and tell the person who prepared the emblems and baked the loaf how much we appreciate that? And one certainly just as important as the other. And I thought that was a good comment too. Just things for us to keep in mind. Where I'd like to pick up, and this is just my list, and I don't even know that it's the top four, but some of the challenges that I see for the church of the future, and I spent some time with the young people on this because they're going to have to deal with it. The concept of keeping the church autonomous and not succumbing to the idea of a hierarchy. And that really dovetails with the third point there, the avoidance of councils and bureaucracy. As we talked about the organization of the church, it's to be flat, it's to be autonomous, and we can't ever lose that. If we lose that, then I think we've lost the church. Strong elderships. I think that's a crucial thing, and I've never been quite sure which is the chicken or the egg. Do strong elders develop strong congregations, or do strong congregations produce strong elders? Probably the answer is yes. But I think if I could have one prayer granted for the church, it would be the development and men who are willing to serve in that capacity and women who are willing to support men in that capacity. It's just an absolute crying need. And let me say, and I don't think I said this yesterday, and they didn't ask me to say this, it appears to me that this congregation is extremely well blessed with an excellent team of elders. And they would probably also say they're well blessed with an excellent flock. And those two oftentimes go hand in hand. Mutual edification, the whole concept of mutually edifying versus having someone do that for us, I think is a continual challenge. In the area of sound doctrine, if I had to guess, some of the things that will give the church the most trouble in the future will be music, and by that I mean the adherence to a cappella versus instrumental. The clergy system that is so appealing, and we'll be talking a little bit about that. I'm not opposed to the clergy system, as long as we understand we're all ministers. It's when we forget that we're all ministers that I become uncomfortable with the clergy system. Communion. We're one of the relatively rare religious organizations that partakes of the Lord's Supper every first day of the week. Smorgasbord, setting aside a room to the side, and when you feel like taking communion, you go and do it. Monthly, quarterly, it's just an issue. Baptism, I've talked quite a bit about baptism, so I have no further comments on it, but that continues to be something to consider. And finances, both what we spend our money on and how we raise money. And there aren't that many religious organizations that solely rely on the collection of the saints on the first day of the week. But it seems to work. Surprise, surprise. It seems to work. I want to talk a little bit now about the concept of equipping the saints. And if you have your Bibles, I'd like to go to what may be one of the most beautiful passages in the New Testament regarding the church, found in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 11 through 16. I want to look particularly at verses 11 and 12, but I want to walk us through just to refresh our minds as to what we have here. In Ephesians chapter 4, Rick mentioned the concept of one spirit. That's found earlier in the fourth chapter. But in verse 11, he says, I gave some apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come together in the unity of the faith. Verse 14, so we're not tossed to and fro like children. It's just amazing how easily some people are pulled away by some new fad. Speaking the truth in love, the whole body fitly joined together to the edifying of itself in love. Verse 16. I want to go back and look for just a moment with you at verses 11 and 12 because I think they're crucial to a couple of points I want to make. And I've heard them explained or preached upon in a way that I don't really think is what the Apostle Paul had in mind. Now in this group of verses, verse 11, we have several offices. Apostles, prophets, and you understand prophets are not simply people that told the future. They are also one of the spiritual gifts. They were people that were able to proclaim the gospel and miraculously through their spiritual gift had the gospel prior to it being written down. And I think that's probably what is the primary reference here, although there could be some reference to that. Those two offices, I think, have passed in that sense. We can prophesy, but not in the miraculous sense, because we don't need that. We've got the New Testament. You open it up, you read it, you preach it, you're prophesying in that sense. And then he lists the evangelist, and I think that's still a function. The function of an evangelist is to spread the word. An evangelist has, I think, a twofold responsibility, but the spreading of the gospel is a primary responsibility. There are some residual responsibilities relative to existing congregations, the appointment of officers, serving at the behest of the eldership of that congregation to do some particular teaching, building up, and so forth. And then we get to, and I've probably gotten ahead of my slides, so let me go back and get back on track. The whole metaphor here in Ephesians 4 is the metaphor of the body. And as members of the body, you can think of yourself as a cell. And the main function, I believe, of the roles that are listed, or the offices, if you will, that are listed in verse 11, is the equipping of the saints. And what the distinction I want to make is I don't believe Paul is teaching that it is the primary function of the offices in verse 11 to do the tasks in verse 12. I think what we're going to see, or what I've concluded, is Paul is saying it's the primary function of the roles in verse 11 to perfect the saints, and the NIV uses the word equip the saints, so the saints can go and do the work of the ministry and the edifying of the body. And maybe that's not an issue in your mind, maybe you haven't thought of it, but I think one of the mistakes that the body and false bodies have made is looking for offices to do the tasks in verse 12, when in actuality, what I hope to convince you of, or at least get you thinking of, is Paul is saying, no, these offices are for the equipping of the saints so that they can do those final two tasks. And I've heard lessons given where even in verse 12 they'd say, well, the perfecting of the saints, that's the evangelist, the work of the ministry, that's the pastors, and just try to tie those two in that way. And I think that's a misapplication, at least it is in my mind, and I'll present to you why I think that. But anytime you see a congregation having problem, remember this metaphor. It's the cells in revolt. That's exactly what's going on. When congregations have problems, it's not the head that's the problem, because Christ does his job. It's the cells in revolt. It's just like if your physical body, if the cells aren't cooperating, you twitch, or you writhe, or you wiggle, or whatever you do. Same can happen to a congregation also. And I'd like to also to remind us that we have shepherds or leaders or elders. They are to tend the sheep. But shepherds don't produce sheep. Sheep produce sheep. And we're the sheep. Now, an elder is also a sheep, so it's okay for him to go out and bring someone to the Lord. But just because he is the elder or the shepherd, that doesn't mean he has more responsibility for producing sheep than you or I do. Because shepherds care for sheep, sheep produce sheep. And I think we need to keep that distinction in mind. Otherwise, we sit on our hands wondering why someone else isn't doing something that maybe the Lord had in mind for us to do. Now I want to look a little more at the 11th verse. Not in as much detail as I did with the young people, because I hope these concepts are even more ingrained in you than it was them. But apostles are ones that are sent forth. And in Acts chapter 1, we get an indication of some of the qualifications. They had to be a witnesses of the Lord and his resurrection. And I think that position, for that reason, if none other, has passed. There are religious organizations that call various functions apostles. And if you're using that simply as one sent out or as a messenger, that could be okay. But I think it is quite misleading to use that title and that function, and it's certainly not to be used in the sense it was used in the New Testament. Prophets, there are foretellers, that's who tells the future, but there are forthtellers, and I already alluded to that, those who could tell forth the gospel, probably tied to a spiritual gift capability at this time. Evangelists are messengers of the gospel, sent out to proclaim the gospel. Primary function, to proclaim it to those that have not heard it. But I wanted to spend a little bit of time on this last one, because I think the King James and the NIV both translate the latter part of verse 11, pastors and teachers. And this is a classic example where the word then doesn't mean what the word means now. If you think of a pastor, you're not going to be thinking of what Paul had in mind. The word that's translated pastor there in the Greek, and I never know how to pronounce these, but pomen, P-O-I-M-E-N. And elsewhere in the New Testament where that word occurs, it's translated shepherd. For some reason, it was translated pastor here. And that's not wrong, especially when it was translated. It might be a little bit suspect for the NIV, because that was translated in the 70s. But the word did not mean what it means now. Paul is not talking about pastors as the religious world thinks of pastors. He's talking about shepherds. And most scholars think that the concept of shepherds and teachers is really one function. It may be slightly different aspects of that function, one the caring and one the teaching, but both of those are aspects. I believe what he's talking about here is simply shepherds, or we would call them elders. But I want to make very clear, this is not a verse that I believe you can academically correctly use for the office of a pastorship or a ministership, as the religious world uses that term. It's not a new office. It is not separate. It's the office of shepherd and elder that's being referred to here. Does anybody want to make a comment on the distinctions in verse 11 before I go a little bit further? I don't really know that I... Well, I do expect Adeline. Yes.
Qualified to be an elder, or if a teacher could be Yes.
Yes. That's right. And I'm not implying that all teachers have to be elders. I'm simply saying that in this verse, those two may be referring to the same function. But certainly, you're not restricted. Well, it's just, you're absolutely right. You don't have to be an elder to be a teacher. You don't have to be married to be a teacher, et cetera, et cetera. A teacher is someone who's simply well enough versed to teach. And I hope in various ways everybody here is a teacher, be it publicly or privately or over the backyard fence or at the car wash. Charles?
That's a little bit like you're talking about the word apostle, though. There's an ordinary usage of that word, anyone understand, and then there's a special usage of it regarding, well, if elders are to be men who are apt to teach. That's part of the basic description. And in Acts 13 and 1, when we look at the church in Antioch, there were in the church in Antioch prophets and teachers, and those things we used to describe people who were in a particular leadership function, not just everyone.
Okay. But certainly all elders need to be teachers, but not all teachers need to be elders. And that's, I think, quite correct. Thank you, Adeline. Yes, you may. You make good comments.
So many times when we see someone with lots of talent, we say, oh, you'd make a great evangelist. And maybe he would. But we need some of these great people to be elders, too. And if we send them all out,
I'm not pausing because I disagree with her. She just, in a synopsis, gave my Eminence 2003 talk in one sentence. I couldn't agree with you more. And there's just a glaring need for both. And well, he said you have to be part crazy to be evangelist. Personal opinion, having done both, being an elder is infinitely more difficult than being an evangelist. And that may simply have to do with it's harder to hit a moving target. I don't know. But by the time you figure out what Charles has said, he'll be in Bakersfield and Rick and I will be in Kansas City. Poor Bill and Dave and Bob got to stay here and untangle this whole mess. I'm obviously being facetious, but there is something about the eldership, and I have served in both capacities, where the buck stops there, and you got to sort out issues. And there's a difficulty in that I have an undying appreciation for. Adeline's comment, I just say amen to. There is just a crying need for both. But if we don't take care of our home fires, then we'll have no place from whence to send out the sparks. And that's as poetic as I can possibly get, and it's probably borderline unpoetic. Thank you. Great minds are in your head. I didn't even have the guts to finish that one. Janice, help me out here. That's just what I was hoping you'd do. My personal opinion here is the use is probably to one office in this case, but I consider the functions two different functions. A shepherd is the caring for the flock, of which teaching is a part of it, but it's much more than that. But probably the way it's used here, it's one, he's referring to one office. Probably, but I didn't sort that out for right now. Do you know? Pastors and teachers. Okay, and or that as. Okay, anybody else? Okay, all of that is part of the point I want to make, but not the ultimate point I want to make. I want to now look at verse 12, because we've got these various functions, all of which have more work to do than they're going to get done. But they are for the perfecting of the saints. Now, the word for perfecting, and I think the NIV probably uses the word equipping, if I remember. Other translations use equipping. I think it's the NIV, but if it's not.
To prepare.
Oh, to prepare, okay.
The New King James
Uses what?
Equipping.
Okay. Equipping is a good, or preparing, all carries the same thought. It comes from the Greek word katartizo, which means to add what is missing so that the original purpose can be fulfilled, to make fit. It was literally the word they would use to describe mending their fishing nets. They would mend their fishing nets so that when they went out the next day, they'd catch fish. What I think Paul, what I'm convinced Paul is saying is that these offices in verse 11, a great function of theirs is to equip and prepare the saints so that the perfecting of the saints to or for the work of the ministry, to or for the building up of the body of Christ. That's the Greek interlinear, the literal translation there. The NIV says to prepare God's people for works of service. And I hope I'm not belaboring this point, but we don't have three parallel phrases here in verse 12. We've got a phrase that says the job of verse 11 participants is the equipping of the saints so that. Remember when I talked about Acts 2:38 and I spent a lot of time on the word for, which is ice, and it means so that. Well, the second and third fours here in verse 12 are that same word ice. So he's saying, I want you people to perfect the saints so that they can do the work of the ministry, so that they can edify the body of Christ. I think this is a tremendous passage as a proof text of mutual ministry. And not just public mutual ministry, all aspects of mutual ministry. At the Murray Road congregation in Lee Summit, I don't think it's still up, but I remember one time I was there several years ago, and above the door, as you left the building, it said something like, you are now entering the mission field or the work field or something like that. Is it still there? And I thought, that's a great idea. Here's a group of people that came together, and yes, they came together to worship God, but they came together to equip themselves, to re-energize themselves, to perfect themselves so they could go out and do what he's talking about here in verse 12. And I think that's a very important part of our local congregation's assemblies. Yes, it is to praise God. Yes, it is to worship God. But there's also a perfecting of ourselves, a building up of ourselves so that we're equipped mentally, spiritually, intellectually, people skills-wise, whatever, to go out and do the work. And I think that's what Paul's talking about here. This is, I've already made this comment. The first four is a paio, and it's a little bit different, but it does mean so that. But the second two, the second and third fours in verse 12 are the word ice, which is a forward looking. You do this looking toward the ministry. Paul's point, and I guess therefore I hope my point, is that God is showing us here in these verses a body that is to be participatory rather than spectator. The Lord's body was always designed, I think, and it was always his desire for it to be a participatory rather than a spectator organization. And I'm not being critical. I think in general, we probably do a pretty good job. I don't mean by that everybody has to be able to do everything. You know, some people just can't carry a tune. Well, do your congregation a favor. Don't lead the singing, maybe, unless you're the only option. But do what we do where our talents lead us. Okay? I heard that this morning too. For those of you on the internet, that was Christy Evans's fault. No, I don't know if it was or not. Okay. Too many churches, because of human nature, I think are becoming spectator rather than participatory. And an analogy that I once heard, I've used it before, and some of you may have heard me use this, I really like it. Too many churches have become like football games. You got 22 people that are exhausted and need of rest, and 70,000 people sitting in the seats who desperately need exercise. Now that describes a football game, a major NFL or college football game. Well, a little tongue-in-cheek there, but that's exactly what a lot of people look for when they look for a church. Where can I go to soothe my conscience without having to get too involved? And while I'm on that point, sometimes even in our groups, I hear people say, well, I just don't feel a part. I don't feel included. Well, maybe you don't, but my experience has been 9 times out of 10, it's because you haven't participated. Now, I remember a woman in a congregation who just felt like she wasn't part of the group, and she homeschooled her kids, and they must have had 5 or 6. So I know she was very capable, but she would never help with VBS. And I always wondered why. And then she would say, well, I just don't feel included. So being included is really, that door lies at our feet to a great extent. Now, the eldership and the congregation ought to try to make us feel included. But you've seen people come in. I've seen examples here in Anaheim just in my brief week and a half here, and I know people come in and they immediately feel included because they join right in, roll up their sleeves, and go to work. And I just bet none of the elders told them to roll their sleeves down and sit down. No, you welcome that, don't you? So if you're ever tempted to have a little pity party about I don't feel included, that's a good time to look in the mirror. That's a good time. Are you participating in the opportunities that are available? And a healthy congregation is going to be a working congregation, and I think that's exactly what the Lord had in mind. Now let me pause and see if anybody has a comment or a question you would like to make. I wanted to touch on Ephesians 4 because I fear that's been misapplied and misunderstood. Verse 12 should read, perfect the saints so that they can do the work of the ministry, so that they can edify the body. It does not read, perfect the saints and hire staff to do that for you. That is not what it means. You know that's wrong, but I want you to understand that's not what Paul has in mind here. Doug?
What about those that maybe don't have a specific natural ability in a certain area but desire to develop that? I think I know what you meant by your comment, you know, do the congregation a favor and don't. I think I understand what your concept was, but at the same time, we need to encourage people to increase what they're comfortable
sure.
or able to do. And sometimes that means the congregation is going to have to bear with a brother that's maybe not a very eloquent speaker, but is getting up there and trying to do his best.
Okay, well, let me go back to the song leading analogy. Some of us are just more talented in that. You know, I sat here the first Sunday, and I don't think he's here, but Greg got up here and sort of, I thought, apologized because he doesn't beat time. And then he's got this beautiful, booming voice. I sat there and said, man, if I had a voice like his, I wouldn't wave my arms either. He just has a real talent there. I mean, I'll never have a voice like that. He's got a tremendous talent. But I know some men who aren't particularly musically inclined that have just been doggedly determined to become song leaders and have become good song leaders. And I got a tremendous amount of admiration for that because they want it. My comment was, maybe you ought to hone your skill a little bit before you do it. But yeah, we want to encourage. But all of us have things that we more naturally gravitate towards. So those are the easiest for us to do. But I have... There's an elder in Iowa, I won't mention his name because of the tape, that's not the most naturally talented in hardly any public area, speaking, song lead, but he does them all, and he does a nice job, but he was just so determined he was going to become that, and I love that. And the reason I wanted to separate that from the one on speaking, our concept of what's eloquent and what God's concept of what's elegant are usually, oftentimes, not quite the same. If we're not careful, flowery words and natural ability, and that's all good if it's used in the right way, but I remember what Paul said. It's almost like he's saying, I'm going to naturally tone my ability down a little bit so it doesn't get in the way of the gospel. I think we should use our ability, but some of the most eloquent and edifying lessons are come from the people that, by man's standards, aren't the most eloquent. And I know you agree with me, but I think that I'd rather hear a guy talk from his heart with bad English than a guy pontificate with excellent English that he doesn't really have it in his heart, and so would everybody here. Jay?
Same in singing, as far as I can
tell. Okay, same in singing. And I've set, well, let me rephrase that. People that have sat in front of me have heard sometimes a person that can't sing always quite right. I think I'm doing it right, but I'm not always. But God's ears are different than my ears and your ears. And personal opinion, I really hate to see anybody not sing. And I've heard people say, well, I can't carry a tune. Well, that's your ears, not God's. So I'm not going to condemn you if you don't sing, but I'd ask you to seriously think about that, because don't let our standards influence you the way God hears. God's listening to your heart, not your vocal cords. Thank goodness for most of us. Yes. I would say a hearty amen to that, and the only thing I might slightly disagree with you is I personally found him eloquent. I mean, he kind of braced us to where he wouldn't be, and then he just hit a home run, and the ball's still going as far as I'm concerned. But yes, that of all the things we may forget from this 2 weeks, that will be one of the last things any of us will forget. And that's from the heart. I just wanted him to keep going and keep going. I had a hand over here and then Dave. Jim?
Quite a few years ago, I thought I'd like to be a song leader. I found that a real good door for you.
Okay.
So
well, you... Yeah, you can use the ones you got, but I think Doug still makes a good opinion. You know, while you're using those, we can develop others, because there's always need for more. And you might... I bet you're better than you think you are. No, I haven't, have I? I know you. I got Dave and then I'll Charles. David?
I don't believe there's any one particular area of service that does require an extraordinary amount of talent.
Good point.
Just about anybody can do just about any job that service requires.
Usually, or often, a deficiency of talent is in our head, not in God's head. I think that's it. I hope that's... I paraphrase what you said. I agree with that. It's for every ounce of talent, it takes about a pound of guts. And we all can get guts. Charles?
Two things. One, I've observed myself, and I've heard others observe as well, that Brother Bennett, in fact, is a very good door figure.
He is.
The comment is we tend to value public performance above other services.
Sure, and I'll let you come back, but one of the things that makes Jim a good door greeter is he's always there on time.
That's right.
Yeah.
We need to value those kinds of contributions every bit as much as some of the more public things that we take in service of life. We get our priorities out of whack.
Yeah, and I think we've got our heads screwed on enough that we know that, but we need to remind ourselves of that. More people have been brought to the Lord by quiet acts than by all the sermons put together. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't exhort publicly. Now, Charles, you had a second?
The other thing is your illustration of the football game, which I agree, I'm not disagreeing.
Good.
But the fact is, a lot of those 70,000 people go to that game because they do feel like they're the business. They're cheering, they're eating the food, you know, they're not playing the game, but they feel like they're a part of it. And that's one of the reasons that a lot of what's going on in that kind of arena atmosphere or theater atmosphere of the church growth movement right now has a lot of appeal, because there's a sense that you're a part of something. You're participating. You're cheering. You're buying the hot dogs. You know, you're moving the thing along.
I think that's a good point, and maybe if I ever use that slide again, I'll stick the word vicarious in there. Because they feel vicariously that they're participating, but the church is not a vicarious participatory, it's a participatory organization. I probably won't put that word in there, but the point is, because I can't say it, but the point is still valid. I'll find a synonym that's only one syllable and put it in there. Did I have any other comments? I really don't want to miss it. This is just such a vital point, because we do sometimes lose members. And sometimes new people come in and they're uncomfortable with the participatory environment because they're not used to it. And we need to be patient with them and not expect them to do this immediately. And let them find their niche, let them find their talents. And I think, I can't prove this, but I suspect there have been people who have avoided coming into the church for fear that they were going to be asked to do things they weren't yet comfortable doing. And we need to be very patient and understanding of that. And as Randy said yesterday, for some of us that have been raised in the church and done it all our lives, we forget how scary some of these functions are. But there's all kinds of functions to do, and let's get off the public and on to the important ones. Dion. She says, what's the fine line between encouraging people to try new things and not pushing them? It's going to depend upon the person, but when it's a new convert that comes from the outside, they often will express to me, well, don't put me on for this. And I always tell them, you're not going to be put on until it's checked with you first. But I said, you're going to be surprised. In a few years, you're going to be ready. And I leave it at that. And more times than not, it's worked out that way. We've got a member at our congregation who just knew he couldn't do anything. I mean, public. Now he gives readings and does table talks. He's not a sermon yet, and that's fine. He may never. But he got comfortable and got ready. So I wouldn't push it. I wouldn't push it. Words like, well, I know you've got the capability, and as the Lord works in your heart, you're going to be ready at some point to do it. That's about as hard as I ever push it. Is that right? Well, that's just the way I do it. Janice? I sure have.
And then what we're talking about is the public
stuff. Yep, I find it.
I find that I believe that one of the biggest things that we have in church today is to concentrate on knowing what's right and doing what's right.
Yeah.
It's the people that go out and visit the sick and tell them to be the better and help them with that.
I guess I'd make two comments on that. Number one, those who periodically stand in the pulpit ought to remind themselves to do more encouraging for that. But you don't have to stand in the pulpit to do that. A card, a pat on the back. Hey, I really appreciate you doing that. I think wise elderships, and there's nothing wrong, for instance, with hiring the yard work done. And I don't have any idea whether you do or here or don't. But at our congregation, we mow about 3 acres, I'd say, of grass. And we could afford to hire that done. We have intentionally not done that because we've got members who can do that and serve in that way that aren't comfortable serving in other ways. And we don't want to take away an opportunity for them to serve. And our mowing schedule list just gets full quicker than, well, quick. And that's an example. And the cleaning of the building. We don't hire anyone to clean it. And we've resisted that because there are people that can do that that don't feel they can do other things. Now, maybe they could do other things, but that's a way for them to serve. And I'm not criticizing any congregation that does pay for those things. I'm just saying, look for things so that we can include everybody in the non-public ways, because that's very important. People that feel like they're working and part of the group are going to be stronger. That's a fact. Adeline, then I'm going to move. Sounds like Bill Norris. And I mean that in the highest esteem. And Lois, yes. Well, we probably all need to remind ourselves to encourage and tell people how much we appreciate these things. But the bottom line is, even if we forget to tell you, it's not forgotten. And that's the key. God doesn't forget us. And that's the whole body working together. And so many times these silent tasks are got to be the greatest in the eyes of God. Dan?
And that's the fascinating thing about the Matthew 25 passage at the judgment time. It's the surprise of the saints. Jesus said, you've been doing these things, and they go, huh? What?
When did we do it?
When did we do that? We don't know. And it's those things. They're not forgotten, like you said.
Yeah. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't do a better job of encouraging one another, but the ultimate is God's ledger is indelibly accurate.
Just a quick comment. While you're saying all these things, I just was reminded of Romans 12 chapter. You go all the way through that, and that's what we're talking about.
Okay. He says, Romans the 12th chapter, and he's right. Especially after you get past the first couple of verses, is a good listing of the things we're absolutely talking about. You know, I don't know how many preachers there were in the New Testament, but Dorcas got her name in there instead of them. And she was making coats for the poor, and et cetera, et cetera. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about attributes of God. I won't get through this, and probably I won't spend quite as much time on this. I won't spend as much as it deserves, but I won't spend as much as on some of the other stations, just because I believe your familiarity with them is pretty good. Randy did this yesterday, but I want to do it again. I want you to think of the opposite. Light, hot, up, God? Okay, gotcha. Gotcha. And I guess I tried to get you. You're not totally wrong. The point I want to make is God has no opposite. Because nothing is equal to God. And to be an opposite, you've got to be an equal in the opposite way. Okay? The magnitude of God cannot be matched either equally or negatively. There is only one God, but he has no counter opposite. Now Satan, and that would have been the answer that I would have given if you had forced me to give an answer, has many characteristics opposite to God, but Satan is not equal to God even in a negative sense. Satan is not, for instance, omniscient. Satan is not omnipotent. And he's not any of those omni words that we're going to look at. He has characteristics that are the antithesis of God, but God has no opposite. Okay? And I think that's a very foundationally important point. A.W. Tozer once wrote, "It is essential to view God correctly, because it is our view of God that determines how we experience everything else we experience." I think that's probably right. Because God provides the spiritual lens, shall we speak, that you and I view everything else through. And that's why the world doesn't understand us. Thursday night, if I stick to my game plan, I'll quote from Tozer again, in which he says, don't be... he doesn't say this, it's a paraphrase. He says, don't be surprised when your neighbors don't understand you, because they aren't going to understand you. Why would anybody want to get up at whatever time on Sunday morning, get dressed, and go to church and mess up the one day of rest? Why would anybody want to do that? They're simply not going to understand that, because...
I apologize for interrupting, but we have two vehicles that are parked in the way of a truck that has to make a turn here for our next door neighbor, and the truck's waiting out there. There's a white car, license 3, BAL211, and then there's a blue, looks like a blue van, 903 PNF. Okay, thanks. Sorry.
That's all right, Dwayne. Nobody noticed it was you. Your secret's safe with me. I understand, and I'm sure it's true, that this neighbor has always been very gracious and accommodating, and we're parking in his lot, so I'm glad that Leon did that, because we want to stimulate that relationship and not hurt it. Okay. Tozer was simply saying, just don't be surprised when people don't understand you, because you're looking at things differently. And the reason you look at things differently is because of that overlay of godliness that we have. And I'm glad we do. I wish and hope that others will begin to view it that way also. Some of the views that people have, and I put two columns here. Some people look at God as being rather with it and hip. That probably dates me a little bit. God is understanding, generous, bears our sins, exists to make us happy, is an absolute bender. Others would look at God and say, well, he seems like he's usually mad most of the time. He provides us a list of do's and don'ts so we know what we can do and shouldn't do. And he must be rather tired of dealing with people. Well, I personally think both of those views, and I suspect you agree with me, are flawed. He has some of those attributes, but not to the exclusion of some of the others. But they're flawed in ways that drastically affect how we live our lives and approach reality. If my view of God is that left-hand column, it's going to flaw the way I look at life. If my view is totally the right-hand column, I believe that's going to flaw the way I look at life. And it's kept some people from coming to the Lord. There's flaws in both of those caricatures because we tend to look at God from a human perspective, and God is not human. God simply explodes our human frames of reference. Let me look at a few of the attributes of God, and then I'll finish this at our beginning of our session on Thursday. God is eternal. Psalms 90 and 2, Psalms 102, 12, lots of other passages you could look at. But God has always existed, and he never had a beginning, and he will never have an end. Now, everybody here knew that before I said it, but grasping that is just a tad beyond us, isn't it? But if you have trouble grasping the magnitude of God, don't feel bad, because if you could fully grasp God, you'd be God. And you're not, and I'm not. So the fact that I can't fully grasp him doesn't disappoint me or discourage me. That's the word I wanted. But yet, he does reveal things about himself. Being eternal, God is not bound by time. And we can't grasp that. My wife doesn't get upset with me very much, but one of the times she does is we'll be sitting in church and I just got to look at this. And it's not that I'm in any toot. I don't have anywhere to go. I'm just time-oriented. You hope. But knowing that he sees the past and the future as clear as the present, and I want to make another comment about this. And you may not agree with this, but it seems to me like when you're eternal, and you never have a beginning and an end, then terms like past, present, and future don't mean anything to you. The Bible talks about past, present, and future, but that's because of us, when God created time. I don't believe time has really any bearing on God. He understands past, present, and future because he has to deal with us. But if you really think about this, if you're eternal with no beginning and no end, then you don't have a timeline, so everything happened in the present. I think that everything with God is in the present. Now, he talks about past and future so we can understand. But I think for me, that explains why in Exodus 3:14, when Moses asked God, "Who shall I say that sent me?" He says, simply tell him, "I am who I am." Now, the phrases "I am" are in the present tense. I think what he may have been saying is tell them, I'm the being that's always in the present tense. You remember when Jesus in the book of John was talking to the Jews and he said, "Before Abraham was." Now, if I was finishing that, I would say, "Before Abraham was, I was." But that's not what Jesus says. Jesus says, "Before Abraham was," past tense, "I am," present tense. Now, how can the present tense be earlier than the past tense? It can be only in this concept of eternity. I think God's always in the present tense, as if everything's happening at the same time all the time. Now, don't ask me to explain that any further, because I can't. But it seems to make sense to me. If you choose to view it differently, that's okay. It's not a doctrinal issue. It's not a test of fellowship. But that's what helps those statements make sense to me. But since we are not eternal, and we are within the confines of time, you're dismissed.